It's all about the panties, baby.
Welcome to the ECECS 252 Introduction to Computer Engineering podcast summary for weeks 5 and 6. These weeks we spent learning about material in Chapter 3, wrapping up Chapter 3 on digital logic. Remember in the last podcast we talked about logic gates, which was the first major topic, then logic circuits from gates, which was the second major topic, and then memory, which was the third major topic. And in this podcast, we basically bring some of these components together in state machines. So state machines are what we use to build sequential logic. State machines have both memory in terms of flip-flops and combinational logic inside them to help us determine what to do next. The design flow for a state machine is basically this. You start with a state diagram, which is based on a written or verbal specification, which often has ambiguities or is not perfectly clear. When we construct a state diagram, the intent is to remove all ambiguity, and ultimately the state diagram has to be complete. It can't have any terminal states where we have no outbound edges. It shouldn't have any states where there aren't edges that leave that state that handle every possible combination of inputs, and each of the states should indicate the value that the output should take on when the state machine is in that state. That's the first step. Once you've completed the state diagram, you move on to the second step, which is to determine the number of flip-flops that you'll need to implement that state machine. And that's just the base two logarithm of the number of states in the state machine. At that point, you can pretty much arbitrarily assign state names corresponding to unique binary combinations given the number of flip-flops that you have. For example, if you have four states, you would need two flip-flops, and you could assign names 00, 01, 10, and 11 to those four states. Once you have that completed, you should fill out a truth table, first for the output function. So again, you'd enumerate all possible states, and you'd then record in the output columns the values that you want the outputs to take on in those states, and then you simply just design combinational logic for each output, again using the familiar AND or two-level logic or the decoder-based logic that we learned about earlier. Then we want to do the same thing for the next state truth table, which provides the signals that we will use to drive the next values of each of the state flip-flops. And again, to do this, we'll basically fill out a next state truth table and again design the combinational logic based on that truth table. State machines are usually used for control of digital systems, in particular data paths, and it is possible to write very complex state machines that can perform complex arithmetic operations, for example something like matrix multiplication or even Gaussian elimination. But as you've probably already learned through your homework, it's a pretty painful and error-prone process. And yet that was really the state of the art around 1940. This is how we were controlling the computing devices that people were building in that time frame. As we learned about in lecture, the Second World War created a strong incentive for the governments on all sides to develop better models of computations. The Germans had their Zeus machine, the Colossus in the United Kingdom, the ENIAC in the United States, and so on. And really the key breakthrough that was made in this era was the notion of making the control unit or the control path of the machine programmable so that you could avoid designing a new control state machine for each algorithm that you wanted to run on your machine. This idea was formalized by John von Neumann in the von Neumann model. In the von Neumann model, you really have four components in your computing system. You have memory, of course, to store operands as well as instructions. You have a processing unit or a data path that allows you to do things like store some temporary values and actually perform arithmetic or logic computations. We obviously also need input and output so that we can get values and programs into the box and can get results back out of the box. And finally, we need a control unit that's programmable. And this really relies on two main components: the PC or program counter, which contains the address of the next instruction, and the instruction register, which actually contains that instruction and what it should do. The instruction processing loop that the control unit implements basically has to do a sequence of things repeatedly. It has to fetch a new instruction based on the current value of the program counter, decode that instruction to know what it needs to do. It could be an add, it could be an AND, it could be a load or a store. It usually has to determine an address so it knows where to fetch operands from. Then it has to fetch those operands. Then it has to actually execute the instruction, so perform the logical operation or arithmetic operation that's required. Finally, it has to store the result back into some storage location. And then you just rinse and repeat. You keep doing that. That's really all the control unit does. What are the instructions that the control unit is fetching? Well, as far as the memory is concerned, which is what of course stores these instructions, they're just bits. And the data type for those bits is really an instruction. And the format and the operations that that data type supports are defined by the instruction set architecture, or the ISA, of the machine. We're going to learn in detail about the LC3 ISA as we get a little bit further into the course, and we'll be using it to implement the course project, which is a Pong or breakout game. The ISA of a machine does not need to be complex in order for the machine to be able to solve complex problems. The complexity of the ISA and the choice of the instructions that you include and do not include in your ISA is really an engineering design and trade-off question. There are different parameters that you can vary along many axes in order to achieve different design goals, whether it might be low power or low instruction footprint or high performance. Whatever your goals might be, you might have very different solutions. And depending on what point in time you're building your machine and what the technology is capable of delivering at that point in time will also affect whether or not you have a good solution in terms of the design of your instruction set. One other point about von Neumann machines, typically we design them to operate in a synchronous fashion. So that means that each cycle will perform one step in the control unit state machine. Now, of course, this need not be precisely instruction fetch in one cycle, instruction decode in one cycle, address generation in one cycle, operand fetch in one cycle, and so on. You can basically pack as much or as little work into each cycle as you, as the designer, see fit. And how much work you pack in will affect the complexity of the logic. The complexity of logic, again, will determine the longest delay path through that circuit, and the longest delay path will basically set the minimum clock period for a synchronous system. You have to have enough time budgeted into your clock period to allow the longest path to evaluate so that you always get correct results. The minimum clock period, of course, then sets the maximum clock frequency that you can run your chip at. So a recent example of this would be the Intel Pentium 4 designs, which targeted very high frequency and consequently did very little work per clock period. They were able to deliver high frequency designs that didn't necessarily have any better performance than contemporary designs from, say, AMD that ran at lower clock frequencies. And the overhead, actually, of running at very high clock frequencies resulted in them burning lots of power. And so a few years ago, Intel changed directions, and now they're building machines that are, in spirit, much more similar to the machines that AMD has been building all along, machines that do more work per clock cycle and run at relatively lower frequencies and end up being a little bit more power efficient than the Pentium 4 line was. This is oversimplifying things, though. Really, the design of how much work you pack into each clock cycle is one in a series of complex trade-offs. And these complex trade-offs are really what computer architects like me do to earn a living. And it's really a lot of fun. Something that, if you're interested in, we have plenty of follow-on classes at this university that you can take in future years. Just a few quick reminders to close this out. We do have an extra credit assignment available for you this week. The College of Engineering Department Fair is taking place October 20th to 23rd in the afternoons, and you're encouraged to attend two of those sessions and turn in a write-up on Monday, November 3rd for some extra credit towards your homework grade in this class. The details of that are spelled out on the website, so check that out in case you don't know about that. Another reminder, the second midterm is coming up. It will cover chapters 3 and 4. That'll be on Wednesday, October 29th in class. There will be a review session, just like there was for the first exam, with a sample exam solved in class on Monday, October 27th. I will be out of town those days, so you'll have to rely on assistance from the TAs, or I will be checking my email as well at that time. Finally, homework 5, which has been out since last week, will be due Monday, November 3rd in class. And a final reminder will come to us from Weird Al Yankovic. It's all about the Pentium. One, 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 one.